I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime! Woo!
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB. I am your host, weekdays 9 to 11 o'clock, providing a safe space to the independent thinkers out there. Next hour, it's Thursday, we'll do our Freedom and Prosperity Hour with the people, the fine people from Americans for Prosperity, and I believe we're going to meet the new state executive director today. She's in from Florida. Everybody used to want a bottle of sand or a bottle of sunshine for Florida. Now all we want is the freedom. We suddenly have become very aware that there are striking differences between the states when it comes to freedom after what we've lived through for the last 2 years. So hopefully she is bringing some of that freedom attitude to us here. I got plenty to get to in the first hour. I'm going to start off with my quote of the day. This may be one of my favorite contemporary quotes that I've seen in a long time because it describes this show. I say we focus our rage towards those at the top, not across the table, not to our neighbor, not to our cousin, not to our friends or former friends because they voted different than us. It's the scorn of this show is directed upwards pretty much at all times. This is Caitlin Johnstone. She's a columnist, very interesting writer. I follow her, a lot of her her posts. Caitlin Johnstone said, "Never let anyone shame you for focusing your criticism on the world's most powerful and destructive government. It is not strange and suspicious that you do that. It's strange and suspicious that more people don't." It's almost like she wrote this quote for this show directly to me. She's speaking to me. "Never let anyone shame you for focusing your criticism on the world's most powerful and destructive government. It's not strange and suspicious that you do that. It's strange and suspicious that more people don't." And when it comes to conservative talk radio, particularly the big hosts, they're playing the game. They get their power and their prestige from being big party apparatchiks. And Sean Hannity enjoys quite the lifestyle, I would imagine. I don't know how much he makes, but I do know it's too much. Sean Hannity gets a great deal of power by carrying water for the Republican Party. And that's why he does that. And he gets the little people to fight amongst themselves. Despite whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you're a young worker or old retired person, whether you're black, white, Hispanic, or Asian, tomorrow is the day that you are reminded that you are nothing but an American sharecropper, allowed to earn a little bit of money as long as you pay your VIG to the plantation owners. Tomorrow is April 15th, tax day. So make sure you stretch out good today. I actually have some more graphic descriptions of how I think you should prepare for tomorrow, but I'll save them since we are on a family radio station here. But tomorrow's tax day, so make sure you are ready to kneel and bend over and do your what they call your civic duty. This is no surprising headline here because I do these every quarter for 5 years now, and the story is always the same. The federal government collected a record $2,121,987,000,000 in total taxes through the first 6 months of fiscal 2022. Another record. That's October through March, according to the monthly Treasury statement. This also marked the first time that federal tax collections have exceeded $2 trillion in the first half of a fiscal year. That's $2 trillion taken out of the private sector and run through the grift operation of our federal government. Of course, It'll be no surprise to anybody who's listened to this show or pays attention to these things that while we have broken through the $2 trillion in less than 6 months of tax collection sent up, stripped of, stolen from the American people and sent to Washington, D.C., even while collecting this record, $2,121,987,000,000 in taxes through the first half of the fiscal year, the federal government ran a deficit of $668,267,000,000. That's because the government spent $790,254,000,000 during the period. This is the second highest spending the federal government has ever done in the first 6 months of a fiscal year. The record spending during the first half of fiscal year occurred in fiscal 2021 when the Treasury spent $3,701,519,160,000 in the October through March period. And I'm just going to remind people, as I am wont to do here, it's inconvenient, but I want to make sure we're placing proper historical context where it belongs. That was during the Trump administration, leading into the Biden administration. Trump from October through January, and the current mental midget Joe Biden from January through that March. So there you go. Record amount stolen from the American people by the criminal cabal in Washington, D.C. of over $2 trillion for the first time, and they still managed to overspend by almost $700 billion. I don't know why people don't care about this. The people who spent this money are Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. They're also Roger Wicker, Cindy Hyde-Smith, and Michael Guest. Now, they are conveniently in the minority now, where I'm sure they rail against this kind of spending. But when they had opportunities, as I say, I've been doing these headlines for 5 years. Record tax theft from the American people and then record deficits at the same time. I did it all through the initial Trump 2 years where the Republicans controlled Congress. I did it through the 2 years when Trump was the president and the Democrats controlled Congress. And now I'm doing it as the Democrats have run the table. This is an interesting statistic about inflation that I think is certainly bears repeating. A lot of Americans understand inflation to a degree. And you know that even though you earn a little bit more each year as during the course of a career, people typically see maybe 3 or 5% increases in their wages from time to time. You may get small raises, you move up a ladder, but unless you get a pretty substantial promotion, even with these raises, most people know you don't really change your lifestyle. Even as your income is going up, you realize, well, I'm not really able to do a lot more things being in the same position. The only time you have a real change in your living standards is when you move from somebody maybe on a staff to become the manager of that staff, right? A pretty big leap. Professionally, that can change the quality of your life. But if you're just in a job and seeing slow wage increases, you realize that's all eaten up by inflation. Some pretty amazing statistics here. Wages in 1973, these are for production and employee wages, but this would not be supervisory wages, but the working class in the United States. In nominal terms, meaning how much somebody was paid dollar for dollar, in nominal terms, wages rose from $4.05 an hour in February of 1973 to $26.95 in March of 2022. So over the course of almost 50 years, wages for the working class rose from $4.05 an hour to $26.95. Real wages accounting for inflation, meaning really what your purchasing power was of those dollars when it's measured that way, in the 50 years from 1972 to 2022, real wages rose from $9.38 to $9.64, about a half a penny per year on average. This is the nefarious, the hidden tax that people don't really recognize of inflation, of a Federal Reserve, the Death Star, I call it, that constantly prints up money, and we did this in spades after 1971 when Nixon, the Republican, took us off of the gold standard. So while wages have gone from $4.05 an hour up to $26.95, the effect on your living standards has been microscopic. Only really a few dimes an hour over the course of 50 years. And as I said, most people kind of understand this because they understand inflation takes a bite out of things. You know that over the course of a year, if you pay for health insurance, college, cars, homes, all of the things that you actually need, people understand that the cost of living continually goes up. We allow our government to tell us, well, it's just 1.5%. No biggie. This is normal. They normalize it. But the left, the economically illiterate left, just cannot seem to understand this. You know, the fight for 15 crowd just does not understand that hourly wages just don't matter. That figure, whether it's $12 an hour or $15 an hour or $20 an hour or $30 an hour. I mean, I would ask any leftist, why fight for 15? Why not fight for 18? Why not fight for 30? Why not fight for $100 an hour? Because if you have an economy like we have, a debt-based economy where money has to be loaned into existence, has to be printed out of thin air, and you send it out into the economy, that number that you get, there's no magic to fight for 15. How's that fight for 15 working out for everybody now? People who are making $12 an hour that went out there and spent all of their energy over the last several years fighting to force their employers to pay them $15 an hour, their living standard has probably gone backwards because of the inflation that was involved, the money printed and put into the economy to supposedly pay these higher wages. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it doesn't matter what the wage figure is. If it stokes inflation, if the way that you get there is through debt and through inflating the money supply, you're just going backwards. They don't seem to get this, but this statistic, over 50 years, wages have gone from $4. You ask somebody on the left, hey, what do you think about wages? Look, in 1972, you were only making $4.05 an hour. And now you're making $26.95. Isn't that a victory? And they would say, oh my gosh, yes, it was hard fought. The problem is that the purchasing power of those two amounts, $4 back in 1973 and $27 in 2022, it's negligible difference in purchasing power. You fought for basically nothing because nobody pays attention to what really matters, and that is a government that overspends and prints money out of thin air. That's what actually matters. It's what people should be focused on. I talked the other day about this, you know, the idea in a movie that gets me all excited because I love chaos. And in a movie where you see something, somebody's been predicting something for a while. Maybe it's the big earthquake in one of the big disaster films. And suddenly they've been warning everybody, look, we're due a big earthquake. Nobody will listen. Oh, those things happen once every 10,000 years. It's not going to happen now, Stan. Oh, yes, it is. I'm doing the measurements. I'm looking at the science. We're due to have this. And everybody ignores him. But then you see this scene in the movie where the tremors start and they focus in on Stan, the guy who's been warning everybody. And he feels the tremors and he says, it's happening. I'm sorry. I there's something about me drawn to chaos. So there's so many of these headlines now in the financial world where I just think to myself, it's happening. This is an interesting one. See, we have bubbles in everything, and this is because the Federal Reserve, and our federal government's been spending, so the Federal Reserve has been printing, and they have created a bubble in the bond market, a 40-year bubble in the bond market, a bubble in the stock market, now about a 13-year bubble in the stock market, a bubble in housing prices. Everybody's seen what's gone, the housing market that's gone absolutely nuts, particularly over the last year. So we've got bubbles in stocks, bonds, and housing. It's the everything bubble. We've also seen the rise of these cryptocurrencies, and I have been particularly talking about these NFTs over the past year or so that just seem absolutely ridiculous to me. If you're not familiar with an NFT, it's this non-fungible token. That's what NFT stands for. And it's basically a digital image. And people have been bidding these things up, trading them, and spending a lot of money on these NFTs. Hollywood is putting out NFTs. It's essentially a picture. It's a digital file created, and if you buy the NFT, you get, this is my understanding of it, you essentially get that file to generate that picture. And it can be anything from some kind of a purple ape on a skateboard. There's all kinds of weird theme NFTs going around out there. And people have been paying thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions of dollars for these digital files. And the thing that has me scratching my head is that anybody can have the image. I may not have the original file of it, but if I can right-click on my computer on a picture of that image, I suddenly have the same image that the person who paid $500,000 for that image has. There must be something weird about it where you're proud, you're excited to tell all of your friends and let everybody know, I have the file on that. Even though everybody else in the world could have that same image on their phone in the same definition, the same characteristics, it would look exactly the same on the owner's phone that it looks like on anybody else's phone who just right-clicked and copied it. But for some reason, it was worth tens of thousands, millions of dollars to say, yes, but I actually own the image. It's just bizarro world to me. It makes tulip mania, at least tulip mania back in, I believe it was the 1400s in Holland. At least you got a flower out of the thing. If you're not familiar with tulip mania, there was a time when people started bidding up the price of tulip bulbs. This was known to have been the biggest bubble, the biggest a speculative mania in the history of the world. They were bidding up for a single tulip bulb. People were paying more than the value of a home back at the in those times. And of course, it just crashed when suddenly somebody looked around and went, what are we doing here? We're buying flower seeds and we're paying more than the value of a home for them. And of course, the whole thing came crashing down. It was known to be the biggest bubble in human history. That was until the rapid rise of Bitcoin. And I'm not taking a position either side on the crypto world, but I will say these NFTs did not make any sense to me whatsoever. This just felt like one of those things you see, speculative hysteria at the top of a financial bubble. That's what it felt like. Well, as I say, maybe now it's coming true and it's happening. There was a lot of press a while back that somebody bought an NFT of the Twitter creator, the Twitter founder, Jack Dorsey's first ever tweet. Now, I don't even understand how you sell the original file on a tweet. It just, none of this ever made any sense to me. But they did this NFT, this image. You own the file of the first ever tweet from Jack Dorsey. First of all, who cares? Anybody who with a laptop, a phone, or a computer can go online and find Jack Dorsey's first tweet and look at it yourself right now. You don't have to spend a nickel for it. You can just look at it. You can right-click it and save it if you want to. But somebody bought it for $2.9 million. The guy's name was Sina Estavi. In March of 2021, he bought the first tweet, a non-fungible token, an NFT of Jack Dorsey's first tweet for $2.9 million. I'm getting to the point of why I say it's happening. The popping of all of the bubbles. Last Thursday, he announced on Twitter that he wanted to sell this NFT, this non-fungible token, of Jack Dorsey's first ever tweet that he bought for $2.9 million, and he pledged to give 50% of the proceeds to charity. Do you know what he was planning on making? Remember, he bought this file of Jack Dorsey's first tweet for $2.9 million in 2021, in March of 2021. So about a year later, he was going to list it for sale. He listed it last week for $48 million. He paid $2.9 million for it. He listed it for $48 million. And then out of just the kindness and generosity of his heart, he was going to give, you know, $24 million of that to charity. It's still a 10 times return with the half he has left. So have I set the stage for this insanity properly? They bought an image of a tweet for $2.9 million, and then a year later attempted to flip it at $48 million. Here's why I say maybe all the everything bubbles are popping. Do you know what the biggest bid on it was after it had been up for about a week or so? the highest offer on this thing that he bought for $2.9 million, has now relisted for $48 million. The last, the highest bid that they've gotten after a period of time that this thing was out there was $280. $280. He bought it for $2.9 million. He listed it for resale at $48 million. He's gotten an offer of $280. This may be the end of this speculative bubble. I would imagine everybody who has got significant amounts of money invested in NFTs right now is a tad worried that maybe they were chasing real speculative insanity. Is this the first shoe to drop? I don't know, but it's an interesting one to me. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But if the money see, as interest rates go up and some of the free money, the Fed says they're not going to print up money anymore, as all of that free money that's been sloshing around, flowing into stupid things like NFTs, as that starts to dry up, so does the market for them. This could be one of the first warning signs of that. We'll see. I'll be right back. I do not take as many phone calls on this show as a lot of local host conservatives do. It's the reason is that my show format is what I like to refer to or compare to album radio. I don't know if you remember this. It's been a long time since we had it. WZZQ in Jackson Market was just a fantastic station, and it was called Album Rock. And the meaning of that was that it did the deep tracks. It didn't just play the hits. You'd hear a lot of songs on ZZQ back in the day that you might not hear anywhere else because they weren't top 40, but they would play music that is deep into an album, not the A and B tracks of the single. And this show is a little like that, and I do kind of deep dives into topics. I'll talk about things sometimes up to an hour rather than scouring Drudge Report and commenting on headline after headline. And a lot of times I've got a lot of research or points to make on something. I'm a libertarian. What I say here is really very different than a lot of conservative shows, and so I try to get that stuff out. It's not that I don't want to hear what people have to say, but yeah, to be honest with you, it upsets the flow sometimes of the show. Occasionally, I really am sorry that I don't take a call on air. Sylvia called me. She was trying to call during the first segment, and I was trying to get through this ridiculousness of this NFT market. But I mentioned tax day. And thank you to Sylvia for letting me know this. I'll be honest, I haven't been paying attention to it. But apparently, tax day has been moved. You've got a couple of extra days, a stay of execution. Just imagine the mafia is shaking down your business, and on the first of every month they come, and they come up to you and they say, "Hey, you got a great business there. I'd hate to see anything happen to it." It's just the implied threat that if you don't pay them the protection money, bad things could happen to your business. But one month the mafia comes and they just send out an email to everybody on the block, the bodegas, the restaurants, and they say, "Hey, we're celebrating some holidays. It's Guido's birthday. We're not going to be coming by to collect to you till the 3rd. So you get those couple of extra days where you're like, "Oh, okay, I don't get shaken down for a couple more days." Well, that's what the IRS has done. They have moved the tax deadline to Monday. The reason is what is so comical to me. The reason for the change is due to Emancipation Day. This is absolutely delicious to me. I can't even really figure out how I most impactfully explain this to you. The irony I see in this, the change in date is due to Emancipation Day, a holiday observed in Washington, D.C., marking the freeing of slaves. That's celebrated on April 16th. Federal employees, of course, are given the day off, including the Internal Revenue Service. Now, I'm not sure why that should have any effect on April 15th, but anyway, they're giving you a few extra days. Tax day is now Monday, April 18th, but I find it especially ironic that the day that they most make you realize that you are just nothing but a wage slave, a tax slave to the federal government, is because they are... they're actually celebrating the end of formal slavery while at the same time enforcing financial slavery of all of the citizens of the country. It's just, I think that's interesting. Am I making that point well? I don't have a lot of time for it. I just talked to Sylvia during the break. I had to come right back on. But there's something very, very juicy about the fact that the day that they force you into tax slavery, they abscond with a third of the fruits of your labor every single year and tell you, if you don't do it, there's going to be whippings. And they are actually using Emancipation Day to give you three extra days on your taxes. Anyway, it does have. I appreciate Sylvia because it saves me a little bit of time today. My April 15th show is always quite a production. A lot of sound clips, a lot of historical context around Tax Day. Every single year, I make a big deal about Tax Day. I guess I've got the weekend to put that show together. I'll be right back. We are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WIAB. Thanks for joining me. Next hour, we're going to have our Freedom and Prosperity Hour with Americans for Prosperity, and I believe we're going to have a couple of representatives, including the new executive director of the state who has come in from Florida, actually a Mississippi girl who went over to Florida, had the prescience to head over to Florida, enjoy the freedom over there, and now she's going to come back and hopefully bring some of it here when it comes to economic issues that Americans for Prosperity work on. So we'll talk to them next hour. I also get a lot of emails. I don't take a whole lot of calls on this show because I got a lot of material. I end up with sheets of paper when I come in here, stuff to cover. But I do get a lot of email from listeners, and I do appreciate that. Particularly, I don't really care about the two-party stuff. The political theater stuff is not my thing. I know Biden's bad. If you got Biden is bad articles, you can send them, but it's not my thing. But I do appreciate fact-based articles. And somebody sent me this yesterday, and it really is quite amazing with this vaccination program that we got going on here. And when you actually look at the data, I did the data yesterday from Israel that said that the boosters were 11% effective with Moderna with 40% adverse reaction rates. And Pfizer was 30% effective with 80% adverse reaction rates. This is Israeli data that's not shared with the American people in any public way. The FDA knew it. They still approved all the boosters. But here's some other little juicy nuggets here. A listener sent me something about Rhode Island. How's everything going in Rhode Island? It must be going great. The Ocean State is 95% vaccinated. So they've got to be sailing through this. You know, we've got another surge, another spike, another rise, a concerning rise in COVID. This is why we're now forced to wear masks on airplanes for another 2 weeks. That should do it. And if you can trust anything, it's when the government comes out and tells you we need to take extra precaution for just 2 weeks, you can trust them. They mean 14 days and not a minute longer, right? We've learned this. Rhode Island has partially vaccinated at least 95% of its population, according to a U.S. News and World Report article published Wednesday analyzing data from the CDC. The article claims that, quote, communities with high vaccination rates are expected to have an extra line of defense against the coronavirus. However, Rhode Island has the highest rate of COVID-19 infections in the U.S. as of April 11th of 2022. With 34,301 out of every 100,000 of its population being infected with the virus. This is according to Statista, citing data from Johns Hopkins University. Quote, as of April 11th, 2022, the state with the highest rate of COVID-19 cases was Rhode Island, followed by Alaska. So one of the highest rates of vaccination. Massachusetts, Connecticut are both tied with Rhode Island at 95% vaccination rates. Strangely enough, has the highest case count of COVID. Isn't that interesting? They've got a chart on here. As of April 11th, this is the rate of COVID per states. And I got to tell you, Mississippi's on the charts. I'm surprised we've not heard from Thomas Dobbs. Or has he already bailed out to some cushy big pharma job? We're getting close. I think he might have been a June 1st thing. And I'll be honest with you. I keep telling you this. I don't watch the news. Maybe he is squawking. And it's just not reaching me. Mississippi is currently at 26,740 cases per 100,000. So that's one quarter of the population supposedly has COVID as we speak, if I'm reading this correctly. I don't know what the vaccination rate settled in at. With Mississippi, we resisted in the front end. The black community wisely took a cautious approach towards the vaccines until the propaganda push really came. And then they decided that they needed to submit to the grand experiment. But anyway, that's just another one of these data points that I think deserves a little bit of coverage, particularly for those who are considering getting boosters or any employers out there who are considering demanding that your employees participate in the grand experiment. I don't know it's going to keep your workplace safe.
At first, I was afraid. I was petrified. I kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights just thinking how you'd done me wrong. I grew strong. I learned how to get along. And so
we had another big line of storms come through yesterday. This is becoming a weekly occurrence, obviously. High winds. Circulation. I didn't look at the news today to see exactly what kind of damage was done, but I do know I was out in it, and it was something to behold. The wind was crazy. Look, if you've got tree issues, this is what you call targeted advertising here. The responsive advertising of radio ads. When we see something like this, we leap into action. I want to tell you, if you had any tree problems, you got limbs down or you've got a tree that was freaking you out last night as you watched it wave over your bonus room, realizing that at any minute you could lose it, you need to call Tri-County Tree Service. They have got crane-assisted, low-impact tree removal techniques to safely remove whole trees or large branches from any urban or suburban situation. This is Russ Borland. He and his team have got the experience and equipment that you need to take care of any tree care needs that may come up. So if storm damage happens, if anything happened to you yesterday or in the past few weeks, you need to let Tri-County Tree Service clean it up. They will also deal directly with your insurance company. They will bill them directly for you so you don't have near the hassle that you would dealing with that yourself. You can find Tri-County Tree Service online at Trico Tree Service. That's T-R-I-C-O. treeservice.com, or you can call Russ Borland himself at 601. Here it comes. This is an easy one. It's as good as a website. 601 Tree Guy. 601 Tree Guy or tricotreeservice.com. Now is the time. He is going to be a busy man, I would imagine. I had some stuff. There's really some very concerning things going on when it comes to Ukraine these days. Now that Sylvia has let me know that Emancipation Day has delayed tax filing till April 18th, and I like that show to be on the big impact day, the day where they're really shearing the sheep, when you can hear the when they really are going after the taxpayers. That's my most impactful day. So I'm going to hold off my tax day show until Monday, and tomorrow I'll have time for more foreign policy stuff. Very, very concerning things going on. Our government wants this war, and they are pushing Russia further and further towards probably some increased hostilities. We should be keeping our eyes on that. I'll do that tomorrow, though. I'll go ahead and play this. I don't know if I would have time. Now I do. This is Kim Iverson from The Hill. When it comes to these shots, Pfizer has been forced by a court. They wanted 75, 76 years to release their safety study data. They were forced by a court to do it early. And so these data dumps keep coming out. You and I have got too much to do to read 11,000 pages every month when they pop out. So we'll let Kim Iverson take a look at some of the first tranches of these documents as they're released and what Pfizer knew and when they knew it.
Well, another round of Pfizer documents have dropped. This is part of the 340,000 some odd pages the FDA and Pfizer wanted to release over the course of several decades. But instead, the group requesting the documents sued, and a judge ordered the FDA to make them available by the end of this year. Well, each round of documents is to be delivered on the first of each month. So this past April 1st, no joke, over 11,000 pages were released. Between these documents and another document released on March 24th to the group, a group called Public Health and Medical Professionals for Transparency, we've learned some bombshells. The first bombshell in the document is that natural immunity works and Pfizer knows it. The clinical trial data showed those with previous infection of COVID had no difference in outcome than those vaccinated. In the limited trial, none of the vaccinated nor those with previous infection resulted in severe disease defined by either the FDA or the CDC. They were broken up into two different groups. The FDA and the CDC define severe COVID slightly differently. The CDC roughly defines it as anyone needing hospitalization, whereas the FDA defines it as anyone needing supplemental oxygen. Either way, there were zero cases of severe COVID in the natural immunity group, whether they were vaccinated or not. And their own data also showed that natural immunity was statistically identical to the vaccine against infection. That's what their data showed. Yet, rather than say people with natural immunity don't seem to need the vaccine, which is what they've been saying in Europe, for example, Pfizer instead spun their conclusion and said, quote, final efficacy results show that the vaccine provided protection against COVID-19 in participants with or without evidence of prior infection with SARS-CoV-2. Another revelation from the documents was that adverse reactions were more frequent and more severe in younger groups. The document reads, quote, reactogenicity and adverse events were generally milder and less frequent in participants in the older group compared with younger group and overall tended to increase with increasing vaccine dose. Older is defined as 55 and older, and the study itself was for 16 and above. So the side effects were more frequent and more severe in people under 55, even though we know the younger you are, the less likely you're to experience severe COVID. According to The Lancet, 16-year-olds have a 99.993% chance of surviving COVID. A 30-year-old is at 99.943%. At 50, their survivability is 99.572%. Only once you hit 60 does it drop below 99%.
So there we go. This is a list of, and I'm going to let her finish up in just a second here. This is a list of what Pfizer knew. And just when you stop and think about this, have you heard anything from your health authorities, from the Thomas Dobbs, from the Walensky's at the CDC, Anthony Fauci currently residing in the Where Are They Now file as he's kind of tried to exit stage left, Thomas Dobbs attempting to do the same thing. Did you hear them say, hey, we have found out through this data, we did find out that the kids out there, the more doses they take, the more likely they are to have adverse events. Have you heard that, or have you just heard them say, go out and get your booster? Pfizer knew that the more doses you take, the more likely you are to have an adverse event, particularly in our younger kids. And they wanted 77, 76, 75 years to release this information to you. Still, though, now the information's made public, still not a peep out of our mainstream media outside of this is Kim Iverson on The Hill.
As being misinformation. The consent form lists several possible side effects, including myocarditis, which many of us know about. But the document says the rate of occurrence is 10 in 100,000 people. And they don't specify age or gender. So that's much higher than previously reported rates of 1 in 50,000 people. Even then, we know the bulk of those cases are in younger males. So when controlling for age and gender, the risk significantly increases. The consent form also states, quote, the effects of the COVID-19 vaccine on sperm, a pregnancy, a fetus, or a nursing child are not known.
Wait, not known? Well, they told us it was safe and effective. No concerns for pregnant people. No fertility concerns. That's a conspiracy theory. What do you mean not known? This is Pfizer's own safety data. They say, we have no idea. We're just going to inject pregnant women. We're just going to see where it lands. We'll just check it out. This is a lifetime experiment. We'll collect the data on the other side, go out there and tell them safe and effective, and we'll start watching and seeing if there's any issues.
And this is something that has caused a lot of younger women and parents of teen girls hesitation, which they were demonized over. And people have worried that there could be long-term side effects affecting fertility. And despite these scientists admitting in this consent form that they simply do not know, It has been espoused as fact that the vaccines don't have any adverse effects on reproduction whatsoever. But the fact is, we simply don't know. Another data, another idea condemned as a conspiracy theory is what's called an ADE response, antibody-dependent reaction. This is when a vaccine ends up triggering a worse illness than what the person would normally experience. And doctors like Robert Malone, who have been sounding the alarm of this as a possible reaction to mRNA vaccines, have been demonized and smeared, yet the consent form clearly states, quote, although not seen to date, it cannot yet be ruled out that the study vaccine could make a later COVID-19 illness more severe. So if it were really not even something to be concerned about, the form wouldn't even bring it up. Yet here it is, saying they can't rule it out yet.
It's amazing to me that on the mainstream media and through all of the public health agencies, they tell you safe and effective, but their own disclaimer, their own pay, you know, something you got to sign, they just kind of put it in there. Hey, this may cause you to get really sick down the line. We don't know, but there's a good possibility this could make you really sick with any disease down the line. So they'll say it on that paper. They just won't allow it to be uttered in public. And this is going to be very interesting. We got several months of these data dumps, and I can imagine they're saving some of the worst for last. Just human nature would suggest that's it. We'll be paying attention to it here on the show. We'll be right back.
Right into this world, all alone. God takes your soul.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB, and it's Thursday. Every Thursday from 10 to 11 o'clock, we do our Freedom and Prosperity Hour. We have somebody in with Americans for Prosperity. For the past several months, we have kind of chronicled what's been going on with the state legislature here. They keep us up to date with good bills that are either making their way through or being defeated, and bad bills that are they're trying to curtail and stop the progress through it. But the legislature has retired now, so the work of Americans for Prosperity keeps going year long. Now it's time to start getting more Mississippians involved. Every time they grow during the course of the year, then the next legislative session, they've got more leverage to bring for economic freedom issues here in the state. Today, we're going to be talking with their new executive director, Starla Brown. She is back to us, a Mississippi girl that went to Florida and is back, and hopefully she's brought some Florida freedom with us. So, Starla, I appreciate you joining us today.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be back in Mississippi after 35 years in Florida. I'm originally from Meridian, Mississippi. It's where I grew up, and, you know, coming back to be able to spend time with family and see if we can impart some of that good policy you were just talking about here in the state of Mississippi.
Yeah, it's you couldn't come from a better state for the point of view of a lot of people, liberty lovers anyway these days, because Florida just seems to be on fire. A lot of people are talking about Ron DeSantis for president. I want him to stay in Florida because I kind of want an escape hatch. It seems like there may be one state out there that we can all bug out to if we need to, and Florida seems like a great place these days.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people in Florida would agree with you. They're not wanting to give up such a good governor who's been imparting a lot of good policy, and the legislature as well. A lot of credit to Speaker there, our Senate President, all of the legislators who've really been working, and especially we made a lot of progress. I think we made more progress in the last 5 or 6 years when it comes to health care, education, you know, coming from that bottom and doing some incremental changes that have brought Florida back to the top.
Yeah.
And you know what? Mississippi can do a lot of those same things. I mean, one of the things we're looking at here is repealing Certificate of Need. It's been a great opportunity to impart the free market in the health care industry. So
right.
We'll be working hard on that in the next year.
What's the legislative makeup of Florida? Are they supermajority Republican, do you know, or?
But I think that we've been able, in some cases in education, for example, we've been able to reach across the partisan divide, if you will.
Yeah.
But it is a supermajority as well.
Yeah. So there's, a little frustrating sometimes. I've never talked to you before, but, you know, I've talked with Cade, and Cade Yates is here too. Cade, I'm sorry, you know.
You're good, man.
I brought
good.
Somebody new in. I just shoved you off to the side, didn't even say your name. The lack of imagination, I think, in Mississippi, because we have so much to do. You know, I mean, it'd be one thing if we were, you know, 15th or 20th in many economic factors, and maybe we were okay with that. But it just seems like Mississippi just needs some to do some bold things to get us off the bottom where we have been for all of my life. I mean, that I've been around. So it is time for some new energy and some new way of thinking. So hopefully there is potential for that here. We don't have thousands of miles of coastline that Florida has. Florida certainly has some benefits to attracting businesses and, you know, people that don't like the cold. We don't have that, but we should be able to have some creativity at the legislative level. Just pull us off the bottom.
Sure. And I think one of the things that you have to just kind of think about, if you continue to do the same thing over and over and over, right?
Yes.
And you're not making any progress or any prosperity for the state, it's time to look at some new and bold steps. And, you know, Kate's going to share with us a little bit today, so I'm going to kind of kick it over to him, if you don't mind. Mike, we worked, I was not part of the team at that time here, but on the income tax, right? That was a big, bold step for us, and got to step in here at sort of toward the end of that and work not only with ourselves, but with coalition partners who've been working on that for the last couple of years. And Kate's got some information and figures to share with you on that, and a couple pieces of legislation that we supported this past year, and our big, bold first steps, but they're first steps, right? We've got
right
further to go to eliminate an income tax.
Yeah. It's not time to drop the mic in Mississippi and say, did it. Yeah, there's more work to be done.
Yeah, unfortunately, we aren't there to elimination yet, but that is the end goal. And so last time when I talked, I want to be clear about kind of where we're at as a state. And by the year 2026, we're going to be at a flat 4% income tax. And so that's eliminating the 5% bracket. And it's going to make it easier on individuals to know what they're paying. But after that, we're looking forward to continuously bringing that number down over time. But again, like I said, definitely want to share where we're going to be at in the next few years. The end goal of the legislation that was passed this year was legitimately eliminating the 5%, eliminating all the crazy, you know, I might be in this bracket. You know, it's the deductions that you get from all of these are, it gets confusing. So now we're going to be going to a flat 4% income tax. And then hopefully over the next, and then once 2026 gets here, we can show the legislature that, listen, we eliminated this piece already. Let's work on it again. Let's get this down another percent, maybe in 2%. And then after that, continue to build it down. And that's all without raising taxes. I mean, this is a flat just reduction because we have been running a $1.2 billion surplus every year. And with, hopefully, with economic growth over the next few years, we can get there. And again, you know, we fought a lot of bills this year that were, you know, we talked about tourism, we talked about the Tesla bill, which just to hammer down on something I said last week. So the Tesla piece is literally Tesla is going wants and all these other companies that are direct from manufacturers just want to do an LLC. They're not doing manufacturers direct sales, but they're just setting up a separate LLC to sell cars. And the all these auto dealers were mad about that. And, you know, they're working within the legal system. And so we were glad to kill a bill that was going to wrench down on these manufacturers that were doing an illegal way to get get an LLC. So that's the good thing is we're able to follow up on those policies. But luckily now we've got Starla in the state where next year with the legislative session, we're going to be working on home-based businesses. We're going to be working on regulatory sandboxes, you know, allowing our state to be a place where people can try things. And then also certificate of need policy. And that's going to be a huge piece. So we're glad to remind people about what we're going to be doing in the state. But like you said, luckily in the off season, we're going to have a lot of opportunities to grow the state chapter. Like next week, we've got on April 19th at 6 o'clock at our office in Ridgeland. You got our Facebook page, Americans for Prosperity Mississippi, and you'll be able to find the address, sign up. We've got a link there. And so if you go there, sign up. We'll have a great get together next week on Tuesday, just kind of sharing where we are, what we're working on. We've got pieces of education. We're going to work on our prison system. We're going to work on a lot of key pieces in Mississippi that can make us a better place. But also throughout the year, throughout the rest of this year, we're going to be definitely hammering on some federal issues which is what Starla wants to bring today as a lot of what our federal policies have been working on. So.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what we need to do. Can you tell when you told me, when you started saying that we weren't eliminating the state income tax, but we were taking it down to a flat 4% till 2026, could you see in my face how I just despondent I got? Could you see all the excitement drain out of me?
Yeah.
2026, We've got to wait 4 years
to get it down.
Flat tax when we're at the cusp of elimination. I got to tell you, God love you people who have got the patience to, you know, have to, because you got to chip away, chip away, chip away, see some success, chip away. And I don't have that patience. So God love it. That's the people like you out there. But anyway, onward and upward. We'll come back in just a second and start talking about some of the federal stuff. You said you went to Mississippi State?
Correct.
All right.
So go Dogs.
Yeah. And you, how long were you in Florida?
35 years. Yeah. So it's been a long time. And I was in Southeast Florida, which is an area that's very, very diverse, right? And our state is very diverse, but there are parts of Florida that are very similar to Mississippi because agriculture and those types of things are also an important piece of the economy.
Yeah.
Tourism obviously is up there, and we hear a lot about tourism dollars and that kind of thing. But when you talk about the state as a whole, agriculture is a huge part of the economy, just like it is in Mississippi.
Has AFP as a national organization, and you yourself, have you gotten ideas that have come out of Florida? I mean, you really are sitting now on a pretty short period, almost like a laboratory of seeing what can make a state successful. They've attracted a ton of population over the last couple of months, which has meant, I'm sure, they've attracted a lot of businesses over the last couple of years by giving their citizens more freedom than other places in the country. So it's got to be a great lab to really go, you know, look, in a short period of time, here are things that Florida accomplished. And I would imagine AFP and yourself got you thinking about some things.
Sure. When you unleash the free market, right, and unleash the potential of the individual and their liberty to do so, it's phenomenal. And there's a lot of policy that we've done in Florida that's contributed to even coming through COVID and, you know, how the state was opened back up and how we worked through those pieces and even taking some of those emergency orders, right, that we had during COVID and actually extending them into, like, with pharmacies, right, and vaccines and being able to implement that. So I can give you a great example just to show you how well freedom attracts people to a state.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt right now the real estate market in Florida is off the charts. But to give you a very solid example of a pastor who's a friend there in Southeast Florida and recently sold his home. And in the first day on the market, he got 9 offers, all of them $50,000 or at least $10,000 was the lowest above asking price.
Yeah.
People are buying things sight unseen. You know, when people have gone through what we've gone through in the last few years, right, where a lot of our liberties and freedoms have been squashed or taken away, when people see that beacon of what that can be like, it's amazing. And so Florida is a great example of where we said, hey, we're not shutting down our economy. We're going to implement good policy. We're going to open things up. And people are coming in droves. And people are coming there for freedom. And, you know, you hear this narrative, oh, well, it's a lot of people, you know, just coming from New York and this and that, whatever. I will let you know that the people that are coming there are coming there for that freedom.
Right.
That's really the draw.
So. Yeah, it's always the concern. You're going to turn our red state purple, right, and then it's going to go blue. But right, I'm telling you, with a lot of people that might have voted differently, I think this has been a very eye-opening couple of years for people to see huge government control to micromanage your life and micromanage your business. How many business owners in New Jersey and in Los Angeles and in Manhattan, how many small business owners are looking around and saying, this cannot go on? I'm sure they voted for Governor Murphy in New Jersey. Because he's been there for a while. I think he was pretty highly rated within his constituency. I mean, New Jersey's a pretty liberal state, particularly up in the upper part. They've got to be looking and just going, oh, no, and this is not what I signed on for. So a lot of people from the left, and I'm not a big I'm not at all about hating someone who voted differently than me. I think it's time to win over hearts and minds. And I think a lot of people organically were won over to the ideas of freedom, liberty, and economic freedom over the past couple of years because it was taken away from them for the first time.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you even look at the education system where the choice in education, that's another example, right? Parents suddenly had their kids at home and they were
right,
looking at whether it was the curriculum or what they were learning or what was going on. And now you see this movement across state legislatures to open up and fund, you know, as Corey DeAngelis says, right, who's been a big person in the movement for foundational education, as he says, let's fund students, not systems, right?
Yeah, right.
And that opportunity to realize that everyone learns differently, but now parents are clued in, and so you see a movement there as well. And I think COVID taught us a lot of things. It really did, and so I really agree with you that once people, even people who maybe didn't take their freedoms as seriously as they should have, had them taken away, it was a perfect opportunity for people to say, we need to make changes. And if that change means that I need to move to a freer state, where that state is prosperous, that state embraces a free market and individual liberty, you see that.
Yeah, and if they go to a state like Florida and they enjoy what they see there, they realize the freedom there. I've listened to a lot of people in kind of national media that may have moved from New York down to Texas in the past year. You know, even people who might, you know, they might call their friends back in California and still tell them, oh, yeah, I'm still a liberal and I still, you know, all this other stuff. But I guarantee you, when they go in that voting booth, they look over both shoulders, see if anybody's looking, and they're going to vote for the people that are giving them freedom and a good quality of life in that state. They're not going to turn against that. Yeah, education is the other thing. And I'm a libertarian guy. And what's frustrating, and I'm sure it's frustrating for everybody, Americans for Prosperity, everything, when you're trying to win people over, you can kind of warn them, hey, you don't want to give the state this kind of power over in your, you know, certificates of need. You don't want the state and the hospital association to have a power over who can open a hospital. You can kind of tell these theories. A lot of people aren't open to that. But when they see it in practice, you know, libertarians have been warning about government overreach, and to conservatives, that they've seen Republican states over the last year issue emergency orders that were never ending, you know, and sometimes you just can't tell people, they have to see. And the last 2 years has been, now you see what we're talking about, you know, exactly. Now what you see, what happens, your freedom is actually important. And I think Americans have been for too long, could never happen here. That kind of thing they'd never tell me I can't open my business. In a Republican state, they'd never tell me I've got to close my business, and then when I reopen it, I can only have 25% occupancy, and then maybe 50%, and then back down to 25%. That's never going to happen in Mississippi. You know, this is the United States of America. It's happened. So now we've got to fix that.
Right. Right. And I think you see, like you said, a lot of people are moving to states who have enacted good policy, right, that really does support that individual liberty and that sort of principle of the free market and getting government out of the way, deregulations, cutting red tape, more open to healthcare. And we have something what we call the personal option, right? Because one of the things that generally people who, you know, lean in towards something that's not a top-down healthcare solution, right, and is that, well, what is your plan, right? That's what you always get asked. And so Americans for Prosperity has something we call the personal option. And love to come on. We have more time and really talk more about healthcare because I know it's something that's important to the state of Mississippi. But in that personal option, a lot of it is comprised of a series of different types of policy initiatives that can lead to more affordable and accessible healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, you know, the top-down approach says as well, everybody should have healthcare, right? But there's a big difference between having a health insurance card in your wallet with meaningless outcome versus having real access to healthcare. And you know what? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people. Recently, we had an event down in Florida. It was all women because women, as we found in some studies, make 85% of the healthcare choices in the household.
Oh, wow.
So they're important. Yeah, key to this. And so we brought in some individuals. We educated them on our personal option and all of these different pieces of policy. Our state director from Tennessee, who's done a wonderful job up there with creating free market policy on healthcare. When they came in, there were women who walked out the door and said, you know, they were so convinced of what this could mean. They were actually to the point where they're like, maybe we shouldn't even have a health insurance.
Yes.
You know,
amen.
So
rethink everything.
Rethink everything, right? And so, you know, I'm not saying that we're at that stage yet, obviously, but there's a lot of things that we can do through good policy that will bring the cost of healthcare down. And if we're talking about healthcare, and if you're a legislator, or elected official, and your constituents are out there and they're telling you they don't have access to healthcare, they don't have whatever, you should be addressing those things that are going to bring prices down, that are going to make it more accessible, whether it's primary care physicians, repealing certificate of need, opening up competition in the marketplace is a good thing. And, you know, there's sort of this narrative that, well, jobs will be lost. That hasn't been the case. I don't see that in the healthcare market in Florida. The jobs are being lost. If anything, it's been the opposite.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, what I try to tell people when I get in conversation, a lot of us, so many regulations are around for so long, and we just believe we have to have this really formal structure and somebody's got to be in charge. And I think, you know, we created a country that within about 150 years leapfrogged over countries that have been around for thousands of years and suddenly become an economic powerhouse of the world. And then we started regulating the crap out of it. You know, it's like we had seen this success and then we started to stifle it. And we've gotten to where we are now, which is just, you know, so many things move so slowly and they slog through all these regulatory structures. But the history of the United States is that of rapid ascendancy and prosperity within this country within a very historically short period of time for a country. And so we've proven it works.
Exactly.
Economic freedom works. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll start talking about some of the federal policies you're working on. We're talking to Starla Brown, the new executive director. State director of Americans for Prosperity. And Cade Yates, one of our favorites. We'll be right back.
I tear my heart open. I sew myself shut. My weakness is that I can't do much. And my scars remind me that the past is real.
All right, we are back. We're talking to Starla Brown and Cade Yates from Americans for Prosperity. So we've got a little bit of a shorter segment here. Set up for us what kind of issues you guys are working on the national level now that trickle down here to Mississippi that you will take action on here.
Yeah, well, it's pretty simple. We're paying more and getting less, right? And, we have invested heavily in a campaign around that. We want to educate people on not only the problem, because I think all of us are feeling it, right? I mean, I filled up my car a couple of days ago, and, you know, the prices were lower in Mississippi than Florida, but it was still $20 more, $25 more a tank than I should pay, you know, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I think we're looking at a scenario, and one of the things that we found is that right now 62% of Americans actually think that their family's income is falling behind, like it's not keeping up with the demand of what they're having to pay, and 83% of voters are saying they're experiencing a hardship due to increased prices. So I think we don't have to look too far when we talk about the falling behind part. One of the things that a recent study has said is that real wages, and so real wages for most people, if you don't know what that definition is, it's really the adjustment.
I explained it to them in the first hour.
Oh, did you? Yes, okay, sorry. Wow. We were on the road, so I didn't hear that. But, you know, the adjustment there for inflation, right? So when we talk about real wages, 2.6% is the downfall that we're seeing right now. Like, so your real wages are getting hit. Yeah, but on top of the fact that your real wages are down 2.6%, we're now looking at essentially about, most studies, around $430 a month that your family is paying out more, right?
Extra $430 a month.
Right. So essentially like $5,200 a year. And it's really a tax. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. You're being taxed another $5,200 because of the acts of inflation.
And it's such a horrible tax, too, because, boy, it crushes it just hits the poorest the hardest. It is so bad for people at the bottom of the rung.
Well, there's such a thing as energy poverty, right?
Yeah.
And that's a real thing. And it doesn't mean that I'm just paying more at the gas pump, because energy affects all aspects of the economy. We've got a couple things here I want to talk about and a little bit about solutions. But here's the real kicker. The solution in D.C., is let's throw more money at it, So trillions of dollars.
Fuel on the fire.
Right. Another budget proposal with another hike here. You know, it's a Congress is considering $5 trillion as part of a social spending bill later this year. You know, so on and on and on it goes. And you know, even if you look at something like the VA, right, who had a lot of problems and spending problems and issues, for years and years it was like, well, let's throw more money at the VA, right, and that'll make access to health care better for veterans. Over and over, segments of the government in D.C. have proven that when we throw more money at it, it doesn't fix the problem.
Education.
Right. It doesn't fix the problem. And so the issue becomes is that, you know, that's their solution. And we all know that in an inflationary period, like printing more money, doing all these things that they're doing is not going to bring things down. It's not this reckless spending and the harmful regulations that we're seeing is really just going to continue to stifle. But the people, like you said, the people that are hurting the most are the people who have the most needs, right?
Yeah.
And but it's hitting middle class families.
It
more
is going. I've talked about this a lot. It's like a water level, you know. And I think a lot of people look at, you know, look at people in the lower rungs that are out protesting for $15 an hour, and they kind of look down on them, like, well, just go, you know, go do better at your job and get a promotion. Now, I'm for that too. You know, your minimum wage is not a lifetime income. But I think what people have failed to realize, particularly kind of in the middle class and upper middle class, is really the desperation over decades now that's been building. And it's like a water level. It's gone up. It's consumed the poor. Well, we just put them on a bunch of social benefits that are just enough. It's sustenance stuff. It's not making anybody happy. It started to encroach, you know, with inflation that's here with us every year. It's gone up into the working poor. It's gone into the working class. Now it is firmly in the middle class. And this inflation is going to take the pain up to the upper middle class. Like you just said, 83% of people right now. That's a big chunk of America. So what are we talking about? That's, you know, 260 million Americans or something along those lines that are already feeling the pain of this thing. Do you talk about the Federal Reserve at all? I'm on this.
Well, that we can do a whole show on that, right, Mike?
I do whole shows on this. And it's such a dry topic that nobody covers anywhere else in conservative radio. But I call the Federal Reserve the Death Star. It's where everything starts. It's where the money comes from to throw away on education for worse results. It is what has created this inflation. I mean, you know, if people could understand what is going on with our central banking and what it has created and has facilitated these politicians, that $5 trillion you just mentioned, that's the only place they get it. The Federal Reserve prints it off. If that central bank doesn't exist, they can't do these things. And so many conservative and even liberal complaints are based around things that can only exist when you have a system like ours that just prints this money up out of thin air. So, see, I'm trying to make you do another show on the Federal Reserve right now. I'm obsessed by it.
That's okay. That's good. You know, well, look, you know, it's not just high gas prices. The grocery store, people are feeling the pinch there. I mean, I don't have to tell you, like, you look at your card at the end of the, you get to get up there.
So depressing.
And then everything, you know, goes through the register and it's scanned. And then you get this number, right? And this magic number, when you start thinking about what I've got in my cart, what am I actually eating, right? And what am I doing? And so when you look at a family of four, it's difficult. It's difficult times. I think we saw some displeasure, though, when it comes to the Biden administration in the Quinnipiac poll that came out this week.
Yeah, where is he at? Yeah,
30, I think it's 33% or something like that. But the one interesting piece of that is that independents, right, who are people who we don't always know, you know, they're going to can be center left, center right, but those people in the middle, right, who often are voters who in the end make some decisions, only 26% of them were see him favorably.
Yeah.
That means there's another 70% or so, right? That don't.
They're the people who move elections.
Right. So, look, the bad policy is starting to permeate into people's minds. And I think we're going to see in the midterms, we're going to see some issues with that as we come around that. But I want to talk a little bit about some solutions because we've talked a lot about the problems, right? But there are,
hold on to that. Okay. Let's do that when we come back because that's the big knock on talk radio. So I'm excited. Everybody says you sit up there and you complain about all the problems. I never give any solutions. I think that's not true about me. I think I give a lot of solutions. Yeah. But anyway, so we'll talk about that when we come back. We're talking to Starla Brown and Cade Yates from Americans for Prosperity. They are they're a national organization. They focus in on state issues here in Mississippi, but they do have national things that go along as well. And I think hopefully educating Americans on, you know, why we are where we are is part of that mission. So anyway, we'll be right back. Stick around.
Citizens from all over the world, this is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees, so will you catch me now? I'm falling.
All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WIAB. It's Thursday. We're talking to Starla Brown and Cade Yates from Americans for Prosperity. Now I okayed a dollar. I play this game every time I hear a song that I don't think somebody will guess. I'll offer them a dollar if they can tell me. I play this with a lot of young kids who don't know my generation's music. I never have to pay out. Cade, I thought you were maybe a little too young to know that song, Werewolves of London, so now I owe you a dollar.
I'll surprise some people because I listen to all kinds of stuff. So
you got me.
Although I will say about the last segment, if anybody wants to learn more about these, because again, we're going to run out of time today to take a real deep dive in some of these, come out to our open house, like I mentioned earlier in the show, next Tuesday, 6 o'clock at our office in Ridgeland. It's off of Woodlands Parkway over in Ridgeland. Go to our Facebook page, Americans for Prosperity Mississippi, and you'll be able to meet Starla in person. You'll be able to meet me in person. We're not that special, but hey, we've got Stone over there. We've got a whole team that wants to meet you and get people involved in the movement that will hopefully set Mississippi apart in a lot of the craziness that's going on the federal level.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, your name says it all. It's got to be – this is the time where an organization with the word prosperity in their name, people are going to pay more attention to it.
Exactly.
You know, we've kind of been lulled into this false sense of security that America is always on the upswing and everything's great. Suddenly now we're seeing some cracks in the foundation, and people are going to start paying attention to the economic issues a lot more heavily. So
exactly. And now, luckily, Starla's got some solutions that we're working on the federal level.
All right.
That we can get to.
Yeah, so, you know, this notion of we're paying more and getting less, right? And that's really what our campaign's about. But there are some things that we can do, right? And I know that we talked about some bold things, you know, that we'd love to do. But there definitely are a few things, and I'm going to kind of go with sort of a top three here, if you will, so that we're kind of taking on tour and talking to people about across the country. But one is unleashing energy abundance.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think we have to talk about pipelines being shut down and everything else and what it does. I mean, all of us are paying more at the gas pump, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things we can do. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is, so there's a review process, an environmental review process for energy and infrastructure programs. But here's the kicker. It's 4.5 to 6 years on average in that review process.
Yeah.
And that alone, you know, if we were to reduce that so that we could, you know, get to a place of energy abundance, a lot of times review process is bureaucracy, right? It's not really about what we're reviewing and that it takes that long. It's just the bureaucracy that's in there. You know, we talked a little bit about wasteful spending, right, early on in this when we talked about the campaign and, you know, how the trillions of dollars that are coming across, whether it's Congress, it's the president, it's you know, there's money out there that we've already injected into the economy, you know, that sort of free printed side of money, right? That's out there. And you know, some estimates say there's about $7 billion that's not even spent. So we need to end wasteful spending. Absolutely end wasteful spending. You cannot continue to spend your way into prosperity. It just doesn't work.
It's so abusive to future generations.
Sure.
I mean, you know, we can see what we are doing to our kids. I don't think it's any strange. It does not surprise me. You've got a young generation that is heavily tilted towards socialism because I think they realize, oh my gosh, y'all are handing off a real crap sandwich to us. We need some help. You know, we've stacked the deck against the future generations by doing this. I think it's so. If you see a story in the newspaper about a mom or a dad who takes out a credit card in their child's name without the child knowing, using their Social Security number, running up a bunch of debt, and then the kid finds out they're $100,000 in debt. It makes national news as a tragedy. We vilify. We want to stone the parent for daring to do that to their child. We do it as a matter of course. You know, our politicians do it on a daily basis, and nobody seems to care.
Right, right. And you know, it's not just wasteful spending. It's, you know, It's spending on things that just make no sense, right?
Worse.
Like our priorities are just not in the right place. I mean, that when it comes to spending, for sure. And one of the things that we'd like to see addressed when it comes to wasteful spending is what's called a unified budget, right? So how Congress operates in the budget process has really waned over the years. And so when you look at appropriations versus, you know, the different subcommittees that would be attributed to that. Congress is just not unified. They're not doing business in the business manner they could be doing in order to get the budget better and to reduce some of this wasteful spending. And so we'd love to chat more about that sometime. Maybe
absolutely.
We can talk about a unified budget on the show. And we certainly love to, you know, we want to talk more about that in our office. So obviously coming by and getting engaged with us, we'd love to show you how Congress could operate better, right? So a lot of times it's not a matter of that they don't have the ability to do. It's just they're not doing it right. They're just going off in a weird direction here. So, but the other thing is cutting the red tape, and we've seen a lot of red tape reduction type legislation at the state level. You know, it's talked about some at the federal level, but there's a lot of red tape out there. It's one of the reasons the prices remain high, because we have unnecessary and duplicative processes that don't really actually get to anything meaningful, right, in terms of reducing red tape.
Well, the government and, loves us and is only trying to protect us. I mean, if there's anything I know, it's that my government loves me and only does things that are in my best interest. Is that not correct? Am I wrong on that?
Right. Well, you know, their definition of meaningful review and yours might be very different. But but when it comes to red tape reduction, one of the things that's so important there is that we have decades of regulations that have just piled on. Yeah. And sometimes we regulate the regulation. Right. And it keeps going. And we have agencies within the government that have power around regulations to implement things that are not even that are outside of the walls of Congress. Right. And so I think one of the things that we need to do is really take a hard look at the red tape reduction, because when we put up a regulation, we put up a barrier, and that barrier to opportunity, to prosperity, to entrepreneurship, to whatever that is, that keeps prices high, we need to be looking at
it. It all adds cost that consumers ultimately bear. It doesn't matter what the regulation is, the cost of compliance with it or the delays in implementing something and the opportunity cost there, every nickel of that ends up coming out of a consumer's pocket in the end.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, those are some of the things. There's other things that we can do, but that's really three areas that we feel like if we could start addressing some things there. And we, you know, and getting people engaged, people need to, right now that you're feeling the effects, but a lot of people don't understand why. Yeah. They don't understand the why. They don't understand inflation in general. And so one of the things that we plan to do, not only at that federal level, but also at the state level, our Mississippi chapter will be investing not just in the next 12 months, but even the next 2-3 years. We're going to be investing in educating the general public, yes, the constituents of our legislators, about the policy, how it impacts their life, what it does, why it's good, why it's bad, why they should support it, why they should oppose it. And I think that the more education we can bring to the communities about how to make the good pieces of policy, the lasting pieces, not the whack-a-mole stuff where it's like,
right,
okay,
yep,
you know, do this. That's sometimes how we get to the regulations, right? It's okay, well, let's put another regulation and that'll help over here, and then next year it's over there. We really want to see lasting policy. When you have reformations, or as I like to say, transformation, right? When you transform something, it's going to be bold. And
yeah,
sometimes that means that we're going to have to think differently about that particular landscape and the political landscape that goes with it. But I think it's something that we can do. And we're gonna invest a lot of time in making sure that people understand how their government operates, how the government is making decisions, and how those things impact their lives.
Yeah, we have a problem in this country of economic illiteracy. And I don't really mean that judgmental, but the problem is, you know, I know all the cute little stickers about Joe Biden at the gas pump. I did that. And he definitely has problems with energy policy. But if people think that they can just vote their way out of inflation, you know, mm-hmm, because what it is, it's overspending, which is facilitated, and it can only happen with money printing. I mean, people have got to understand these things, because you can't fix a problem if you don't understand what's causing the problem. So anyway, we got to take one more break, and then we'll come back, finish up here with Americans for Prosperity, Starla Brown and Kate Yates. Stick around. We'll be right back.
From all over the world, this is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees. So will you catch me now? I'm falling.
All right, final segment for the day. We're talking to Americans for Prosperity, Starla Brown and Cade Yates. So we only got a couple of minutes left. Hit us with what we can expect out of Americans for Prosperity, how to get in touch with you, and we'll touch again on your event on Tuesday.
Okay, great. Well, Tuesday, April 19th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the office. You go to Americans for Prosperity Mississippi Facebook page, find that information. If you need additional information, you can reach out to Cade Yates. His email address is actually C, as in Cade.
M. Yates.
M as in McKenzie.
Yep.
M. Yates at AFPHQ.org. If you want to just email him direct, but our Mississippi, Americans for Prosperity Mississippi Facebook page is a great place to find the event information, the link there to register. We hope you'll come out and join us.
It's just an open house stop.
Just
in,
an open
say
house.
Hello, meet everybody.
We're going to talk a little bit and going to meet some of our team. We have some people flying in from from our national team that will be with us. As I said earlier, we're investing a lot in educating people. We want to train people to be better activists because one of the things that we're going to focus on really is starting a grassroots movement in this state. And it's going to be around the policy, right? It's going to be around that impact. And so we want to make sure that people have an opportunity to hear who and what we are, hear more about what we do and what we're going to be investing in utilizing our time for the next legislative session. But we're open to hearing ideas and exchanging ideas and working with our partners and the people of Mississippi. And we just want to make Mississippi a better place for people to live and work, right? And get government out of the way.
Yeah, I think people are more receptive than that than ever. There's definitely there's an agitation and an anger at the grassroots level right now. It's whether or not we can channel it in productive ways to actually effect change ultimately. There's a lot of grumbling going on, and people, you know, school boards all the way up to national politicians, people are getting and they're not going to get any happier with probably through the rest of this year. So anyway, grassroots is important.
Yeah, no, I agree. I know people are good and angry about a lot of things, and rightfully so, but channeling that into productive work, right?
Yep.
Learning how to be a better advocate, something we call a social change entrepreneur, right? Someone who's really out there, a leader in the community, and being able to engage in grassroots in an effective way. And so we have a lot of trainings that we can offer people to do that. So if you're someone who's saying, I want to get engaged, I want to get involved in grassroots, I want to have some impact in my community, come land with us and talk to us. We'd love to.
Your grassroots your grassroots training can be used in other areas. If somebody's not actually interested in AFP things, but they want the strategies on how to work with their political system, you guys teach them how to do that, and then they can just take that information and go work on their own cause.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. Okay. Tell us websites again to visit.
It's just going to be Americans for Prosperity Mississippi on Facebook. And then also you can reach me at myates@afphq.org if you have any further questions or if you just need directions or anything to the office. So.
Okay. And that's Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, right?
Correct. Yep.
There will be some food involved.
There will be food, okay. As always.
This is always what I want to know. You know me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want my one monthly meal off of Americans for Prosperity. Starla and Cade, thanks so much for coming in. To everybody else, we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.